What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fudge Muppet. I'm Scott here with Michael and Drew. As always, this is the Elder Scrolls podcast, and today we are talking all about the web spinner herself, the Daedric Prince of lies and murder and sex, too.
Although I would say it's a specific kind of sex. It's like I would associate like marital sex with Mara, like in just sex for enjoyment with Dibella, and then Mephala's sex is a slightly deranged kind. It's like, I want something from you, so I'm going to use sex to get it. That's what Mephala's all about.
You guys at home want to support this channel on Patreon, because we've now just demonetized the video by saying all that at the very beginning, link is down.
This is purely educational. This is like a academic textbook.
We'll see how we go.
She's the Daedric Prince of kissing. And it's, you know, it's all about, none of that stuff. It's just kissing.
And cuddles.
Honestly, Mephala is the most cunning, meticulous, and like, she's kind of a cold and calculated Sigma female, really. Like, everything she does is for a purpose. It's for her own gain in some way or another, even if we're not really privy to why that is.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if it's like a... It's a Daedric Prince of determinism who has actually found a way to manipulate the webs of fate. So it's like if you could imagine a big interconnected orb with massive strings going everywhere and all the interconnections between different people. And then she, you know, as a, like a web spinner, plays with that and kind of has control over that and manipulates that to get what she wants.
That's an interesting thing about it, is if you imagine, like, we normally describe Mundus as a wheel. You know, it's kind of, you've got the outer rim, then you've got the spokes that go into the center, and the center is Mundus, the mortal realm. And if you look at a spider web, it's very similar in construction, except much more detailed. There's much more going on.
Naturally, as like a Daedric Prince of secrets, her truer, sort of deeper philosophical understandings are quite different from just the surface level. Like, because, you know, the Western perception is relatively simple. Like the sort of demon of murder, sex, and secrets, it's quite tame. But I did a whole video on it called The Complexities of Mephala that goes into the far deeper understandings. But I'll just quote Diveith Fear first, because he says, talking about Adedra, some of them do perceive mortals as mere playthings, but I do not suspect this of Mephala. She does nothing without purpose, perceives all of Orbis as an interconnected system of action and consequence, and employs herself in spinning new threads to influence outcomes. To what end? That you must work out for yourself, as I have. Do you think me fool enough to reveal the secrets of the Prince of Secrets? So that's what Diveith Fear says about her, and instantly there, it kind of already like nods a little more towards this sort of interconnectedness with the ideas of action consequence, hence sort of fate. And you know, you can attach this to sort of deterministic ways, but we can talk about the obvious really quickly, which in real life there's examples of mythological figures and stuff related to the weaving and stuff, and like of things as the weaving of life and fate and so on. So you've got like the Moirai of Greek mythology, or the Nornir of Norse mythology, like weaving at the foot of Yggdrasil and so on. But in this, what's an interesting point that further ties her to fate within the actual lore is that she is considered the brother sister of Hermaeus Mora, who we know is the demon prince of knowledge, and who's told to be constantly scrying the tides of fate and so on. And there's even a text, I forgot exactly which one it is, but it even refers to that, you know, he's a hoarder of all secrets and all knowledge, whereas Mephala just loves the juicy ones, the little hidden secrets and so on.
They're almost like secret because they're secrets, like the gossip queen who wants to know the latest scoop that nobody else knows and is real hush-hush.
But it's all obviously for a purpose in her sort of grand scheming of this sort of web. There is some sort of greater purpose. And interestingly, you can draw some extra illusions, like we were talking about the wheel, but like the spiral skein being an imitation of that, that's got this sort of pillar in the middle with these eight different sections lined out. It's sort of a copy somewhat of the metaphysical structure of Nern, or at least as we would perceive it.
But far more creepier and terrifying.
Yes, absolutely. There's all each one of them are representative of these different sort of like.
Well, while we're talking about it, we could actually kind of read what's kind of in each space in there. So you have a cavern devoted to lies with pedestals pretending to hold up the sky. Then the second one's made up of cramped chambers representing envy, while the third is a, like grottos filled with maggots and seductive light. I believe the light is maggots, it's mentioned.
Do you want, I've got the actual stuff.
The text itself is better if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, so like... So spun round this pillar, like spokes, are the eight strands of the skein, to each its own space, and to each space its sin. First is a cavern of plinths and pedestals. Each is a lie, for they pretend to hold up the sky, and the sky is the greatest lie of all. Second are the chambers of envy, for compared to the cavern above, they are cramped and confined, and therefore they hate the cavern. Third are the grottos, alluring and seductive, for their walls and ceilings glow like a million stars that sing a song of love, but the glowing lights are maggots, and the song they sing is decay. Fourth are the tunnels of fear, for they are eternally dark, and where there is darkness, there is dread. Fifth are the halls where fair is foul, and foul is fair, and every belief is a betrayal. Sixth is the arena of murder, for every shall betray... Forever shall betrayal be followed by murder. Seventh are the arcades of avarice and appetite, for contained therein are all things mortals would kill or die for. Eighth is the flaming skein of fury, for as death comes to all mortals, therefore all treasures are lies. This is the spiral skein. The tower is one, the strands are eight, the lessons are forever.
And of course this is like a grand metaphor for kind of the creation story of the Aedra, the divines who... were trapped in the caverns of this mortal realm. They hold it up. They're the eight spokes that hold it up, and they decry themselves as the, you know, the god saviors of all mortals. You can't exist without us, and the, you know, the sun and the stars is actually just them fleeing, and you know, it's kind of what Mankar Cameron talks about, of these imposters who essentially usurped Lorcan's creation and act like they're the brilliant ones.
There's a lot to talk about, Mafala, but to quickly barrage some, I want to like... shelf one idea to talk about later, which I've talked about in the video about the play in civilization, the creation of civilization that Mafala has. But because we're on the topic of sort of like you're just talking there about like creation and so on, using the 36 lessons of Vivek as well, and some of the quotes in that, you can attribute the anticipations of the tribunal, so the good Daedra, Mafala, Azura, and Boethia, and you know their reflections being Almalexia, Sotha, Sil, and Vivek. In the 36 lessons of Vivek, there's a lot of story there about Vivek somewhat mantling, basically, you know, the anticipation of Mafala, like becoming through Mafala. And I just want to find the quote because it is. Good. Because they hold on 1 second. Just give me 2 seconds. So Mafala and Azura are the twin gates of tradition, and Boethia is the secret flame, is one of the quotes from Sermon 6 of the 36 Lessons of Vivek. And Boethia and Azura are principles of the universal plot, which is begetting, which is creation. And Mafala makes of it an art form. And there's this whole idea that Mafala is essentially the vehicle of creation, of sort of like, and we can get into the ideas later of sex and murder being almost like a form of creation, procreation. But you have in there, it might be a little easier to understand them as their reflections, where you have Boethia and Azura reflected by Sotha Sil and Almalexia, who can be envisioned as the mother and the father, whereas Mafala or Vivek is like the joining component of that. It's kind of the union of both. It's the contradictory ideas of both the theory, which is embodied by Sotha Sil, and the terror, which is embodied by Almalexia. If you also want to go into one of my favorite quotes, which I'm going to pull up right now, which says, according to the codes of Mafala, there is no difference between the theorist and the terrorist. Even the most cherished desire disappears in their hands. This is why Mafala has black hands. Bring both of yours to every argument. The one-handed king finds no remedy. When you approach God, however, cut both of them off. God has no need of theory, and he is armored head to toe in terror. And that's obviously talking about the idea of the Godhead, and that, you know, theory and terror is not going to do you any good against the all-encompassing terror that is the truth of the universe, and your theory isn't going to help you much against, you know, God. You know what I mean?
Mm. I feel like that doesn't really relate much back to the spiral skein and its reflection.
Look, well, there's no, a lot sorry, of strands.
More, to tie that back more neatly, because I got a little carried away there.
He just went on a massive lore binge.
Well, but the reason I brought that up and all of that poetic connection is Mephala's role that is somewhat hinted at in the plot of Mundus and of creation, and even her reflecting that in the spiral skein and calling that all, you know, saying all lies are truth and so on. It's kind of an actual relatively accurate representation of what is kind of the truth, because the mythopoeic nature of Orbris anyway, because like as the Elder Scrolls, for example, like they're shifting and changing as the stories are written, or, you know, it's the kind of idea that these contradictory ideas that that all of the different creation stories are true. And really Mephala can be said to embody contradiction as one of her main themes.
Well, that would be why as well you look at Vivek as the anticipation of her. And he's got obviously his two different sides, and also his two different themes. One being this kind of like benevolent, generous lord or king. And then he also has this idea, which isn't really seen much, especially in like, you know, mainstream society, but that he is dark and that he does have kind of like deep, hidden, lustful desires. And there is that other side to him, though he doesn't, you know, really show it much unless you go investigate him deeply in the lore.
There's something fairly simple you can extrapolate from all of that as well, and that's kind of like it's pragmatism and practicality. Like it's something that is essential. Mephala's essential role in the Good Daedra is that both Azura and Boethia, in their own ways, are very emotionally driven gods. You know, you've got Azura is very vain. She gives out love but she also needs it. And Boethia, you know, I recently put up a theory about the Chimer essentially being a love letter to Lorcan, and, you know, like Boethia betraying Trinimac is very like heart on the sleeve acting, whereas Mephala is very practical. And in a way, even though Vivek is, you know, warrior poet, he is also very practical. He kind of keeps everything going while Sophocil is off doing his own thing, and while Amalexia is fairly unpredictable when it comes to her love versus her anger. And, you know, Mephala is calculated, and everything she gave to the Chimer was very practical.
And I suppose in some ways, if you look at Vivek's actions, you get into this whole idea of like lies and misleading people being useful and potentially like a good thing.
I mean, their own good.
Like, it gets tricky, but if you agree with this idea that he murdered Nerevar, for example, and then this led to this golden age for the Dunmer people for thousands of years, where they had, you know, all this flourishing and prosperity, it's kind of like what came out of a deceitful act, out of a betrayal and a lie to the people, ultimately was a good thing for them. And I think it's also interesting. There's also the whole idea about Bardow, and like this concept of like if he's holding it there to keep the people kind of in awe of his power and almost in submission. But then again, it's like if he truly is working in the interest of the Dunmer people, then is that a good thing? Is that a good lie that he, you know, or a good kind of manipulation that he has done? It's that kind of concept, I think, where you really see the elements of Mephala being represented in him. But another good way to look at her lies as well is thinking of them as myths. And then obviously like going to this idea we often talk about of like myth makes reality. But it's like a lot of myths are not true until they are, or until the belief in them makes them true. And therefore it's kind of like all lies are truths. Like there's definitely some juice there.
It's like the truths of the universe in terms of how we understand truth as an objective sense of truth can only ever be like, you need some kind of omniscient being to truly understand everything, because otherwise everything else becomes, it's somewhat malleable or incomplete in understanding. But speaking of Vivek killing Nerevar and, you know, betraying Nerevar and starting up the whole Golden Age and, you know, stealing the power of the Heart of Lorcan and all that, I guess that ties into the ideas that the principles of Mafala are kind of essential to the proliferation of a high civilization. Of so, I mean, some people might get, like, I saw there were some comments and stuff on this actual video that were kind of like, oh, you know, not all society is like that bad, but like every single society, bar perhaps small little tribes that just hunter-gatherer style tribes or tiny farming communities, outside of that has been built on blood, on slavery, on all kinds of horrors, on genocides, everything. Go to any culture at any single time, and they've all done something to someone else to assert themselves, and they've created stories and mythologies to justify themselves against over others, yeah, and so
complete
on.
Complete lies and atrocities, but it can be as simple as, like, you know, these people are bad over in this other province that we want to take over because a bunch of made up reasons that aren't true. Mm-hmm. And then that civilization goes and takes over and justifies it with a kind of myth or a lie. Mm-hmm. And ultimately that, while it was really bad for, you know, the victim, improved the situation of the people telling the lie. And of course, we're not here to justify that that's a good thing, or that what Mafala preaches is, you know, a nice way to conduct yourself. But there is no doubt that obviously it's effective and has been used by all kinds of societies for thousands of years.
Well, because specifically in that example too, I'll actually say this quote. There's a quote about the Codes of Mafala in Sermon 11. So according to the Codes of Mafala, there can be no official art, only fixation points of complexity that will erase from the aura of people given enough time. This is a secret that hides another. An impersonal survival is not the way of the ruling king. Embrace the art of the people and marry it. And by that, I mean secretly have it murdered. Now, you can also, like, sort of throw in an extra little thing to secretly murder something, to marry it. Marrying also, you know, sex is involved in marriage. And it's sort of both, it's like kind of like love as a form of violence there. But the idea there is that for someone, there's a few comparisons I drew in this, but it's the idea is that to marry an idea, you can properly
control it and manipulate it.
So, like, the example I gave was, like, say, you know, a celebrity, like, you know, some DJ Khaled type or something, you know, he's like marries the idea of sneakers, right? So he bonds himself and his own identity with sneakers, and then the sneakers he chooses, or that perhaps he designs to create, then has a undeniable influence on the sneaker culture as a whole. But he has married the idea and then imposed his will essentially onto it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So using that similar ideas, the tribunal, they murdered Nerevar, they killed him, they did the wrong thing, but they marry themselves to this idea of Nerevar, which is the fixation point of the Khmer culture at the time, because he is the big leader and everything, so on. And so they spin this, you know, tragic story of Dumak versus Nerevar. All the ordinators wear his mask, his visage on their mask and so on. And they, as his, you know, loyal tribunal, carry on this sort of this kind of golden age, whereas the reality is completely different. It's a giant lie. All of Morrowind's golden age is built on this lie. But
politicians, I think, are another good example of that.
Yeah.
Whether it's in Elder Scrolls or in the real world, if a politician aligns themselves with an ideology, and the public begins to associate this person with this ideology so strongly, you know, that you could say they've married themselves to this idea, they can actually influence it, what that idea means, in a very subtle way, and often takes time to do so, but they can. And I think that's a perfect example.
Yeah, absolutely. And
you're just obsessed with sneakers.
There's more. it's just a fun example. Another one, obviously, is like corporations or something, mm-hmm. with like social causes and stuff like that. But overall, the idea is that, you know, art will change and so on. You have this ever evolving, like, king or leader. If you want to be the ruling king, as they say, you need to control the culture, essentially. But when it says an impersonal survival is not the way of the ruling king, it's kind of pointing to, like, say historical rulers that have gone conquered giant swaths of territory but haven't ingratiated themselves in the culture and sort of controlled it, when the empire falls apart, like you could look at like Genghis Khan or Chinggis Khan or whatever you want to say, or Alexander the Great, it falls like that, and then often the remaining kingdoms become very much like what their original culture was, because they haven't successfully married the idea.
I mean, England is the perfect example, isn't it? You know, it's like taken over by French kings 1,000 years ago. The nobility never bothered to really become a part of the culture, and that's why it's still called England after the people who came before. You know, it didn't change.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's all of that, and the importance of, and this is why I was sort of posing the idea that Mafala is a god of civilization, in that without her principles, no civilization can truly get to such a high point. Because you need to, like Liza, I was sort of pointing out, like, you know, if only the peasant knew that it was only stories and mythology, which is kind of like a lie told as a truth, that separates them from the noble, because, oh, this is a noble bloodline, and, you know, they so on. So all of these kinds of, all caste structures are functionally built upon some kind of, like, mythology or lie or whatever. So she is essential. There's so many lies, and, you know, you don't see where your iPhones are created and in the conditions they're created in. It's kind of that kind of principle. It's your very, like, modern society, to the point where we are, is very far removed from
reality.
The reality. Or, you, for example, like, you know, as the idea, it's like you take a shit, goes in the toilet, disappears. To you, it's disappeared. It's not in part of your thing anymore, but that is going somewhere. In the same way, when you open that chocolate wrapper and you toss that wrapper in the bin, you forget about it. It's gone. It's vanished. It's no longer part of your, like, current consciousness. But what that is going into is landfill somewhere. You know, there is actual, we're very disconnected from the moral obligation to the effects of the society. And that is the way, only way you can have a society function at large. You can't have every single person, you know, grieving and slaving over every sort of injustice that their, you know, advancement creates. Because otherwise, everyone will be mega depressed, and you know what I mean.
Or at the very least, everyone has to deal with the fact that they're kind of a hypocrite. You know, I mean, it is created.
But that's the thing. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but it's like Mafala very much embodies that contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and contradiction absolutely. In general.
And that's how. I was just gonna say that's how Vivek could be a benevolent king, but he's still the same person that, you know, assassinated his friend. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, well, as a simple example, I see that hypocrisy in myself all the time, because I eat meat like most people, but then if I'm watching a TV show or something, or if I'm walking through a farm, like through farmland, and I see there's a cow that's going to be slaughtered sometime soon, I feel like a pang of sadness in my heart. And it's like, just because I'm not there watching it happen, it doesn't mean I'm not taking part. But, you know, this is a whole vegan debate that somehow
connects
to Mafala. But you get the idea that, yeah.
But exactly. That's what I mean. It does connect to Mafala, in that her codes are what are used to create, and her sphere is essentially used to create any lasting society.
And that's is that Nerevar needed to be a martyr. His martyrdom. Yeah. It created this hero, this Christ-like figure.
I'm not sure how true it is, but it's funny how they say her sphere is not known. There's a quote saying her sphere isn't known, but then here's a bunch of things she's about. It's like, kind of sounds like her sphere is known, but it sounds cool.
Although the one thing about that is you can't really, I mean, unless we're going to get some revelations here, is you can't really put your finger on what her grand ambition is, what she really cares about personally. If there is such a thing.
Well, that's why everyone thinks that she does. I know Daivath Fear says she doesn't, but that's why people think that she does enjoy treating mortals like playthings. Because, I mean, in a lot of her quests, that's what it looks like.
Although he doesn't, he's the one who specifically says she doesn't, right? Like everyone says.
Yeah, that's
she,
what I'm saying. Oh, okay, yeah.
Because, that's the thing, is if it were about messing with mortals as playthings, you wouldn't really think that her web would expand beyond the Mundus, but there's the idea that it encompasses the whole Orbis, is that she's interested in everything, even beyond it.
I wonder if her by the way, we should also say that another one of her names is the androgyne, the like androgynous, basically, like she appears as male and female, and this is important for the kind of inherent contradiction of being both and the kind of same deal.
Just to clarify Vivek. As well, I'm pretty sure she appears, she chooses what to appear as depending on who she's trying to manipulate. It's very different to, because we know that Daedra can appear as, you know, male or female kind of representations. But she specifically, I'm pretty sure, is said to appear as the one that is most likely to be able to influence the subject. Not just, oh, I feel like appearing this way.
Yeah. So I have this kind of idea about Mephala and Vivek, and that out of all of the anticipations, you know, there's this general idea that you know, that the saints, the tribunal are now saints, and that the reclamations of the true good Daedra, and they're returning to the path and so on. But I have an idea that Mephala would be the one that is least wronged, I guess, because even her sphere of lies and secrets murdered, all that kind of stuff, kind of aligns with Vivek's actions. And Vivek, even in himself, I would kind of say that perhaps she was supportive somewhat of this idea of an ascendancy or something through lies and secrets. It's all part of a thing. The reason I was saying this is Azura is obviously butthurt about the whole thing, because she creates the whole Nerevarine prophecy. And you can argue, kind of like you were talking about with Boethia, Drew, in the run of the recent videos, but the idea that, you know, it's he or she is really in love with Lorcan and his creation, and would hate the screwing with the heart and all that, and then returning back, you know, back to Monkey with the good Daedra is the way that he would want things. Whereas perhaps this ultimate goal, like, we can kind of assume this is like that some sort of ultimate end goal for Mephala, or all a plan or causality or something, is perhaps leading to someone achieving Kim and then the new Amaranth or some stuff like that. But that all gets very out of law, kind of, you know.
I know this, I don't know if this is, well, it's not off topic, but I just was sitting here and I'm thinking of all the examples in the Elder Scrolls universe in which, you know, quote, lies or myths have actually been so, so useful. Like, I mean, you even look at like Alicia and her creation of this new pantheon, where she blends elements of the old and the Oldmer and the Nord pantheon together and creates all these different kind of representations of gods in a way that's kind of like a lie or like a thing she's made up, but then it becomes real and it becomes useful and it leads to a prosperous society. And I mean, you can even look at, but all sides are doing this. And I mean, you can look at the Empire and Scott, you've talked about the whole flawed idea of like the Septon dynasty and like the different bloodlines and how it kind of like doesn't make sense. And that's like a lie, but it keeps someone in power and it keeps the kind of presence of this dragon blood or the idea of it alive.
Yeah, like even the idea of Talos as just this sort of, you know, one man, Talos from Etmora, who came and just was so good he became a god, rather than the more convoluted story with Ismir Wulfarth and Zurin Arctis and the whole Arcturian heresy. Mm-hmm. Like that being the
similar reality. And the Thalmor as well, constantly, you know, telling lies to grow in power and say that they, you know, helped so much with the Oblivion Crisis and that they brought back the moons for the Khajiit of elsewhere and that, you know, all the things they say about men. And it's just funny to see all the different, I suppose you could say, propaganda and tricks and manipulation all being used by the different empires and provinces and societies of Tamriel to further their own agenda and grow in prosperity, but then obviously come into conflict with one another.
Talking about the preservation of civilization, I feel like it's kind of crazy that we've gone this far into a Mephala podcast without bringing up the Morag Tong. Mm-hmm. But the Morag Tong are a organization of assassins of Khmer origin that are basically a cult that worship Mephala, and they celebrate, you know, sex and murder in her image. I don't know. They do it for her, right? but in instruction, the actual purpose of the Morag Tong has actually stopped Morrowind from collapsing into all-out house wars like they used to, which were big, violent conflicts. And instead, by providing this sort of alternate kind of like just trajectory that's nice and tight and small and kept small, like just, you know, an assassination of someone or a small dispute, it allows the houses to settle their grievances without causing, you know, wayward destruction, which then would prevent the, you know, advancement of that civilization, whereas they can kind of conduct this hidden... It's kind of like, I guess the way you could even think about it, in the same way that, like, you know, people have theories about, and not even theories, some of them is just straight up true, is like the CIA intervening and doing all of these, maintaining all of these, you know, doing maybe some assassinations here, a coup here, and all that kind of stuff to protect the interests of the USA. So in a similar way, while it is obviously is different in motivation, the idea is that these shadowy, secret undercurrents of the civilizations that do all these dark, you know, sinful stuff in the dark can help preserve the greatness and the good of all
of
the peace.
Their interest and their people. It's definitely one
of their
side.
Own. Oh, 100%, 100%. Like we that's what I mean, of the Dunma. Yeah.
Like we said with sex, it's specifically why it's important to use the words like murder and assassination as opposed to killing. Because, you know, if it was just killing in general that was part of her sphere, then she would be the warlord Daedric Prince, you know, mm-hmm. who is worshipped when armies go into battle. But no, it's very specifically individual assassination or murder for some ulterior motive.
Another idea just to throw out there that relates to this is that all civilization and peace, basically in peace times, can only really exist with the threat of violence. You know, it's the kind of idea that everyone's got nukes, and if there is some, if someone shoots a nuke, well, everyone's going to die. There's that violence that everyone's going to die. No one wants that. Yeah. So basically, there is this constant, and you know, the idea that, you know, if you murder someone, you're going to be arrested and taken against your will and put in jail, or you know, in more these societies, you're probably just going to be murdered, executed or whatnot. But that sort of like, it's kind of like the idea of using both terror and theory. It's the terror, the threat of violence.
Yeah.
That ends.
So the Morag Tong is like mutually assured destruction. They're the nukes that every great house leader has a button in there.
Yeah, in their more or less.
It is interesting though, because obviously if you have a bunch of great houses seeking power over one another, it would feel quite unfair. Like, oh, that was our best guy. Like, because at the end of the day, they're all trying to get more power in one way or another. It doesn't have to be like with military might or something, but they're all seeking to elevate their own status in the world. And so you can't help but feel that many would feel very wronged, and it's hard to understand how all the intricacies work, because then you'd think they would be like, okay, assassinate their person, and assassinate this, and by the end of the day, the Morag Tong has just legally slaughtered.
We'll remember all too, of them. By using the third party, like, you don't know who's assassinated you,
but like often, you know the Morag Tong has often.
You know the Morag Tong has, but you don't know who hired them. Like this secretive third
but you'd
party.
Guess, you'd guess, so it's, and then you could hire them.
Oh, you, for sure, you could guess.
And
so
how
on,
does the Morag Tong decide what's the right move and what's not? Like it gets.
Well,
down
it seems
to
in the
very
hands of Vivek and the.
Well, yes, yeah, it gets interesting. There are plenty of problems. It's part of why they entered that golden age. Other than having living gods protecting you. At the end of the day, you know, kind of like the success of the Cyrillic empires is that the greatest success generally comes when there's a person or a group of people who are kind of like unassailable at the top, who rule everything. And, you know, the Morag Tong aren't the arbiters of justice when, at the end of the day, the tribunal have more power than them.
It almost feels like... Sorry.
No, that was pretty much the point.
Yeah. I was hopping in because I saw Scott was going to hop in, and I wanted to hop in. You go, Scott.
I was just going to say that it's important to remember that the Morag Tong aren't the arbiters of justice themselves. They're the tool in the same way that Mephala embodies the art. Yeah, obviously there's always exceptions and things, fluxes and so on. It's a mortal organization of mortals, like things are about to happen. But in the same way that their patron goddess embodies the art form of things of sex and murder. I forgot where it was. Or maybe it was even on a forum somewhere. Someone put it very nicely, but she it's sort of like murder without hate and sort of sex without love. It's like kind of the art form of the actions themselves, of the changing of the meta morphosis, you know what I mean? Kind of. Yeah.
What are you gonna say, Michael? Oh, hard for me to even remember. Something about the Morag Tong, and it's just an interesting concept how, you know, it's almost as if you are one of the great houses, you have this massive incentive to be peaceful in your growth, because you know if you become too warlord-like or too aggressive, it's probably going to be decided by the higher ups that this guy's, you know, threatening the balance and we're going to take him out so this doesn't lead to, you know, lots of violence and things like that. Yeah,
absolutely. A good segue potentially could, unless you have another one.
I was going to take a segue, but what's your
I was just going from Morag Tong to their splinterer, which is the Dark Brotherhood, and the idea that the Night Mother
come back. So.
Yeah, so there is obviously the idea that Mephala is in fact the Night Mother, and is that when the assassination of Reman and later the Potente Vesidu Shay, when that happens, the Morag Tong, everyone gets really, really scared of Morag Tong on it.
Don't
on
they
a
write their
scale.
Name in blood on the wall?
Yeah, like, they got too
Morag cocky. Tong yeah, was
a bit
here.
Of hubris on their part for sure.
But basically, then they end up being outlawed, and the only way they could find any kind of protection was just being restricted to Morrowind and so on. And they had to deal with Vivec and to do this. And there's this idea that they sort of shifted and listening to it and following Vivec's orders and everything, rather than just this pure worship of Mephala sort of death cult. And it lives on as the Dark Brotherhood. And while they don't consciously acknowledge that the Dark the Night Mother, they think they've Night Mother's this woman that died in, I think it's in Breville or something, and murdered her own children, and she was told voice. There's this whole like nice little story about it, but there's this idea that all of the spirits and shades that you actually see, and even the voices you hear, is actually Mephala. And what is interesting is something I noticed in 36 Lessons of Vivec. There is a, I'm just going to find the exact one. There is a mention when, you know how Molag Bal and Vivec get it on, right? And they create all of these demon children, right? And Vivec, there's a quote here, and that's called, that event is called the Pomegranate Banquet.
There's a perfect example of Vivec being like Mephala, like kind of seducing Molag Bal and you know, getting
exactly.
benefit from that.
And so the way he could write about mortals with the truth. Third, he recalled the Pomegranate Banquet, which is obviously that whole interaction, where he was forced to marry Molag Bal with wet scriptures to cement his likeness as Mephala and write with black hands. And that little section there is what happens is he has all of these children with Molag Bal as a result, and those children, he goes off and kills them all. And it's very much like the story of the Night Mother, who gets it on with the Dreadfather Sithis, has five children and kills them all. So it's kind of like they're just saying that Vivec, it's, you know, it's his process of sort of mantling the anticipation that is Mephala.
And after whole conversation of Mephala's truths not being, you know, conspicuous, that plays into it perfectly, that if she is secretly the Night Mother, she has no drive to actually make sure everyone knows it. It's not about that. It's just about getting, you know, it's about what happens. It's not about necessarily why they do it. And that, even like just as a slight aside, that plays into the whole debate about whether Mephala played a role in the betrayal of Trinimac. You know, the idea is that Boethia consumed him, but there's one story which the orcs tell that Mephala was there as well and stabbed Trinimac in the back, and that's the only reason Boethia was able to best Trinimac.
I like to think so, and I think also just because I liked, that's how I sort of tend to lean, and mainly because I feel like it's in both of their spheres, and sort of thematically it makes sense to, you know, to assassinate essentially Trinimac with sneaky means, because Trinimac was like the most powerful. But also that the Khajiit really believe that Boethra was the mate of Mephala, who did not forget her love for her after she was sent into exile for the rebellious nature. But another just sort of tight connection there, and you can kind of just imagine them teaming up to assassinate. It's funny that Azura plays such a big role with the whole Nerevarian prophecy and such, because in their early formation, it truly is sort of Boethia and Mephala mm-hmm. that are mentioned in the early days of the Chimer. But yeah, so
well,
that's that. There is more Khajiit stuff on Mephala, which is really good. If you want to get into that, does anyone else have other directions they want to take it? What I was going to say is that about Mephala, which it's just spelled M-A-F-A-L-A instead of E-P-H, but they say of her in The Wandering Spirits that she watches over eight of the many paths, each of which a Khajiit must walk in time. Mephala aids the clan mothers in guiding the Khajiiti people along the path and protecting our secrets from others. So Khajiit have these paths... So there's these paths, of which are there supposedly many of, but she aids the clan mothers in keeping their secrets and you know, propagating their society. And if you look at the clan mothers are also the ones who dispense the myths and all of the teachings about their spirits and gods to the Khajiit people. So Mephala having a role in that is sort of, I mean, you can really see it is kind of what... How we are talking about how lies and mythologies and stories and stuff giving birth to like greater civilizations, and in order to maintain it, it's kind of what happens with the Khajiit and these ideas of keeping secrets. So, you know, it would be the idea of keeping the secret that nothing truly separates the peasant and the noble in terms of blood. It's just this sort of lie spun to sort of create this hierarchy that's necessary for a large growth. But also, she's also known as... In Khajiit mythology, she was responsible for something called the sinner suicides, basically, where she fell out of favor and so on. And the idea, you can kind of look into like lies and sort of secrets and shame somewhat, but perhaps whatever devious means of starting a civilization. So, for example, if you want to look at Vivek, him killing Nerevar, there is... a sort of shame that he feels with that. And in the 36 lessons of Vivek, he even hides the passages that basically connect the dots and say that, you know, he murdered Nerevar. Obviously he has some sort of like cathartic kind of ability to sort of throw, to not kill himself. But the idea there with the sinner suicides is, or at least how I've interpreted it, is that these Khajiits, they're these early sort of somewhat sinful, horrible things that they had to do that, that then they committed suicide because they, unlike Vivek, couldn't deal with like the shame of it and so on. And so then they couldn't bear keeping these secrets, because I think it's also, she's known as the phrases, the recorder of hidden shame and guilt. Mm. So, you know, they found this guilt by it. But once again, you could look at the good Daedra, all three of them, because in Khajiit mythology, she's closely associated with Azura and Boethia, but also Lorkhan, and having those three together, and there's that similarity in the Chimer pantheon. But they're kind of these, you see these three together in a very foundational stages of any society, like Azura, huge in Khajiit mythology at the start. If you interpret Mephala in Khajiit through the Khajiit lens, as I have, that she was, you know, there's these hidden guilty things that they've done at the start, these evil things to basically grow their civilization. Or what was the other one? Boethia. Boethia is a little bit different in Khajiit mythology, but the same principles apply to the a good Daedra in Dunmouth mythology. And what do you think about all that?
Mm. Well, I mean, you know, the Khajiit were created from a deception, you know, Azura taking Nerni's children without her knowledge as well. So,
yeah,
you know, very much like the origins of the Chimer. A betrayal takes place before the race is born.
Yeah, absolutely. Did anyone else have any other place they want to go? Because we've still got things. We've got Ebony to bring up.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I really like about Mephala, which I researched a bit after reading a really good sci-fi book called The Children of Time, is just the fact that she's a spider. Obviously, the idea of the web and having, you know, many limbs for the, you know, the hands she's got in all of these different political machinations and things like that, that's all pretty cool. But I was looking at the way spiders communicate, and interestingly, if you this probably doesn't apply to all species of spider and whatnot, but generally speaking, on their web, they can feel vibrations from one end of the web to the other, and they can tell if it's prey that's landed or if it's a mate that wants to try and court her. And it's like it very much is tied to vibrations, reverberations. And there was a study a few years ago that it's like to spiders, the threads of their web are like guitar strings, and they can pick up very specific frequencies. And it ties in really well to just the way Mundus exists, you know, the whole song, Lorcan's beating heart. You've got all the different connections to music, especially in Morrowind. And I just thought that was really cool. And, you know, the idea is that if they're perfectionists as well, so if they mess up a strand, they'll consume it, digest the proteins, and then do it again. And you can see that very much with the way she interacts with her followers. So say she chooses a champion to wield the Ebony Blade, they're carrying out her will. So it's not just using, you know, she wouldn't just use them to be a plaything. There's always something to be done to make the web more perfect.
And very much like using that, like the web as a metaphor for her understanding of all causality. So she's constantly like listening, like, you know, feeling the vibrations of all these threads and sort of trying to, you know, manage it. As she will.
Even just like conversations, you know, like if a group of people are plotting to overthrow a king or something, just like the vibrations for a web, she can sense those, and she's privy to everything. And it's like, you know, you can see why, you know, another reason beyond what we talked about earlier of why she's connected to Hermaeus Mora, because I feel like of all gods, she's privy to the most.
I was going to say, I could almost imagine this idea, as much as it's debated whether or not she enjoys mortals as playthings, you can almost imagine, you know, she's listening to these or feeling these vibrations in the web, and then she knows what the prey feels like when someone gets tangled in the web or the song, and they kind of like, you know, fall down into a dark state or a state where they could become prey or manipulated by her into doing something else. So you need to know how to walk the web to play the song.
Yeah.
To win. I don't know. I can just imagine some cool poetic stuff with that.
Yeah. And I think we kind of touched on it before, but there's this whole idea, because of action and consequence, she would have, you can posit the idea that she has a lot of insight and has a lot of predictive capability, but obviously, like every single one of the Daedra, they are infallible in some degree. Like, you know, you have Hermaeus Mora didn't have the secrets of the Skarl or stuff like that. Like, these are still people you know, entities within the Orbis. They're not omnipotent, so they still have blind spots. It's why Mephala couldn't get the ring, her ring stolen from her eighth arm, while Regin had sex with her, because he later became the thief god and so on. But
he embodies her pretty well. He used her own trick against her, essentially, like seducing her and manipulating and stealing her ring.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is pretty impressive. I said this to you two once before, but we should really make a video that's about kind of like all of the love affairs between mortals and Daedra, because there's quite a few. I think it would be like an interesting piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting too. She's said to be the sister of Hermaeus Mora, like as far as knowledge and stuff goes. I like that.
And basically to consider that, just because I don't really see the Elder Scrolls as deterministic, right? And people can argue about whether our real world is deterministic, but it is largely, it's like causality plays a part, but there are ways outside of it. For example, if it was deterministic, it's kind of the idea that you could read an Elder Scroll, which is the fabric of the universe, essentially, and then you read it and then it says perfectly what's going to happen. But the thing is, it's ever changing and shifting under your eyes and so on. It's because there's this kind of, and in the way that Mephala would be working, there's this constant approximation, constantly
Couldn't you, just to play devil's advocate here with determinism, which we won't go down that rabbit hole too much, but couldn't you say that it could be determined due to cause and effect that someone does try to read an Elder Scroll and therefore it changes in front of them they read it?
About that, I mean, you could take this argument to what I'm about to say now, but one thing about Mundus specifically in the Elder Scrolls is that it's kind of Lorcan's spitting in the face of determinism. It's like Anu's perfection. He takes limitation and created Mundus as like like the house of Siphis. It's all about limitation. So it's where chaos runs free. So it kind of, maybe the Elder Scrolls were deterministic, but since then it's like it's been meddled with and now chaos reigns supreme.
Yeah, I kind of like that because it's very different to our world. Like even, you know, the way that the creation stories and the realities of those collide, and there's so much contradiction. You know, I would generally go with the idea that it's also like there's no being that has total control or knowledge, or it's kind of like, I feel like a lot more of these, it's like how do Hemaeus Mora and Mephala and these people have like blind sides really when they've got these huge models of causality and so on, or Hemaeus Mora scrying the tides of fate, because even the language there, like tides, like they flow, like, you know, flow in and out, tides of fate. So it's malleable.
But it's hard to know the truth.
And the same as the Nerevarine prophecy was failed like multiple times until it wasn't. And then it's kind of like, was it determined to be the 12th one or whatever it was?
But it's hard to say. And I think because they have blind spots, like you don't know how hard it is to scry, you know, the tides of fate. It might be really hard. It might be like deciphering. It might be like an archaeologist trying to decipher some faded ruins on a, you know what I mean? Some runes on a wall or something.
I also think, it's,
and there's multiple Kaupers too. So it gets really confusing.
I also think thematically, that's why I think there's deterministic elements and causality is a huge part of it all. But I still think free will is a component there. It's especially,
you have to have it. Because it makes the world more interesting, I think, in an Elder Scrolls universe specifically too.
Even Vivek, like the whole achieving of Kim and the idea of the eye and so on, it's kind of exerting your will, which you can't really have without, if you don't have any will yourself, if you're just a machine.
But couldn't you say he was determined to exert his will? Like anyone being free, that's why I said I don't want to get into it because you can always say.
But thematically, forget all that for the moment. But thematically, like it's even oppositional to, like, for example, Sotha Sil's Clockwork City, which has created this perfect sort of thing of order that's better than the reality of Mundus and so on. Yeah. But
anyway,
it's order versus chaos, and you know, chaos is essential to the story as being kind of like, at least I interpret it as being the force that can't be determined. That made it essential for the soul of Anu, Anwiel, Auriel to be able to reflect upon itself and receive feedback that they couldn't control in any way, shape, or form, you know. But anyway, yeah.
All right, so there's one part I want to talk about, and I want to get your guys' insight and ideas on this. But one of the things mentioned in the Wandering Spirits is she is an ally of Azura Boethra and Lorkaj, naturally, but her numbers are 8 and 16, and obviously there's the idea that there's the 8 spokes and the 16 spaces in between being the Daedric Princes of Oblivion and so on, but that can be debated and so on, so we won't go too much into that. But it says, and these are two of her keys. And obviously in the Khajiit mythology, there's a few things with keys and the idea of the skeleton key and stuff like that. But with being numbers 8 and 16 being two of her keys, I don't know what you think there. But to throw another thing on there, like I was mentioning before, that Mephala and Azura are the twin gates of tradition, and Boethia is the secret flame, but also Boethia and Azura are the principles of the universal plot, which is begetting, which is creation, and Mephala makes of it an art form. There is also the idea that there's a quote that goes, the heart of the second serpent holds the secret triangular gate, which is the idea of the triangle truth. Look at the secret triangular gate sideways and you see the secret tower. And obviously that's the sort of seeing the wheel sideways or so on. And with that, you know, triangular gate with being the triangle truth, it's kind of like all of these things are somewhat related to the metaphysical structure of the Orbis as you would understand it from reading the 36 lessons of Vivek. So you've got the wheel, the 8 spokes, and the 16 things with the spaces in between with the Daedric Princes of Oblivion. Then you've got this kind of idea that both... Who is the gate? Sorry. Boethia and Azura are the principles. Like I was sort of saying, they're opposites. You could also look at Amalexia and Tothe Silver, so on. But Mephala making it an art form. And then I'm just trying to like kind of see, is it's also like there's that word used a lot of gate. So like there's this concept like gate and then keys, two keys being the unlocking. And
yeah, because, you know, like obviously Azura is also called the keeper of all gates and keys. And you've got the story that Noctra stole one of Azura's keys, which you assume is the skeleton key. And there's all kinds of potential involved in that that you can delve into. But the way I've kind of seen it, which might actually be simple and not too well thought out so far, is that kind of the way the Dunmer subscribe to this triangle truth that Boethia talks of, the Jacage that the Khajiit have is kind of what the keys and the gates are referring to, because it's like essentially the Jacage is the cycles of the moons. It's what the lunar lattice, it holds everything together in the Khajiit pantheon. So if anything were to go wrong, that's why you have like the main who climb the lunar lattice to set the moons back on their path. And it's my way of interpreting it has always been that that's kind of just like keeping the mortal realm complete and working and operational. And to unlock those keys and break the cycle is to kind of essentially destroy the mortal realm.
Or to break free from it, at least. Or could it be, if you look at the heart of the second serpent holds the triangular gate. Look at the secret triangular gate sideways. You see a secret tower. The secret tower within the tower is the shape of the only name of God, I. Do you think it could also be Kim?
Well, like, it can, there's also the, I imagine there's this, for the Khajiit, you can leave, you can escape, break through the lunar lattice and leave the mundus, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're breaking the cycle. If you know what I mean, it's like it can be.
Yeah, it's hard to like. This is a lot of conjecture, but there's one of the quotes about her in the Wandering Spirits is she watches over the eight of the many paths, each of which a Khajiit must walk in time. And I can't remember, but I think I've made the comparison before to that and the six walking ways mm-hmm. that are mentioned are the different paths to sort of like ascendancy through in Dunma theology. So I was kind of wondering if these eight paths, each of which a Khajiit must walk in time, perhaps it's just the eight, maybe it's stages of life or something to truly get to that area. But there's a lot that this is the problem with Mephala. Obviously there's a lot of mystery and you're never really going to get to the end of it. And even like Divaith Fear, it's like, I know the secret, but you know, you don't. But I think that's enough to really look in and treat her as a much more, that there's some side of sense to the end of it. You know what I mean? Like she's doing something. There's not, it's not just a, not just.
Or maybe that's her ultimate lie. And Divaith Fear, after all his years of living, thinks he found the truth,
yeah.
but in fact was tricked with the ultimate lie.
I feel like if he's he found the truth, wrong. He wouldn't just be chilling in a mushroom tower, kind of looking after diseased people and having sex with himself in the form of his children. But you know,
there's another thing too there to consider is, you know how they say that only. That only when Boethra, Mephala, and Azura are together that they can basically summon the ebony warrior or blade or this hidden sort of god. I wonder what...
Oh, that only they know the name
That only
of.
They know of, or they're the triangle things. I wonder if it's some sort of idea, you know, you get the keys of Mephala or the others and unlock the gate and then you can... I wonder sometimes.
It's like a nuke. You need all the different.
And it being also, it's interesting that an ebony sword is actually described as one of the descriptions of this embodiment thing or whatever. And here's the perfect segue, but the ebony blade is one of Mephala's most notorious artifacts.
How do you two kind of wrap your head around in a more realistic way, not a gameplay way per se, how the ebony blade becomes more and more powerful? Because, you know, it's kind of like we've talked about before, but if you were an assassin and you sneak up on someone with an iron dagger, like, you shouldn't have to poison it or for it to be Daedric for you to kill them in one shot by slitting their throat. So what does the ebony blade become?
I guess
if you try, as you betray, because that's how it gets more powerful. You have to betray people who trust you, and it gradually grows more and more powerful. I suppose there is obviously the absorb health enchantment. You could just say it gives you more and more vitality the more people you kill with each new strike on another foe. Or do you think it could kind of, don't take this too literally, but become more like a lightsaber, like it's just so hot that it slices through armor? Because remember, Jarl Bolgrif tried to destroy it by putting it in the Skyforge, and it said that the coals in the Skyforge actually like cooled because of the power of the blade. Like, you can imagine this katana just smashing through armor and flesh and just cleaving through in clean swipes. What
do you
think? It sounds
kind of like the One Ring, doesn't it? Like, you put it in the fire and it stays perfectly cold and it relishes on deception, you know?
Yeah.
I like the sharp idea. I like it in that sort of sense that imagining it so sharp that it just, like, you know, cuts like paper through like armor even and so on as it gets stronger. Because
it's
hot, or,
you reckon? Because it's got that Daedric heat
on. Maybe not even. Maybe if it's just a magical sort of thing. Because I mean, this is purely just thematic, like kind of like taste, but I feel like Mephala, like even it cooling other things and it being like the coals, or it being like, you know, like a whisper, or like a whoosh, like cutting through something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, okay, you know, that's
slicing
cool.
it. And, I mean, that's another thing we should actually talk about, the Ebony Blade, but like Mephala through it seems to whisper to you, and she and someone instructs you to kill. When you kill, when you betray people specifically with it, it grows in strength, but she speaks to you through it.
As I kind of see it as, almost in a literal sense, it's her fang that she gives to someone, and it kind of just takes a, you know, perhaps she can give it a different shape or give it kind of aesthetic ability, you know, ability that doesn't actually really get to the bottom of what it is. But, you know, like, I mean, slight tangent, but is related to the Ebony Blade, is, you know, one of the names the Khajiit give it is the killing word, which we've, you know, put together a video on that. And the killing word seems appropriate because of everything about her sphere of lies and deception. Is that, you know, if you boil down the sentence, it's like a word can be more deadly than a blade. It's like, you know, a king ordering an execution, or somebody sorting out an assassination or whatnot, like giving the
or
word.
Telling a lie,
or telling a lie that gets someone else, you know, inculpated for a crime.
It's why the Vivek is both a warrior and a poet, and uses terror and theory, both hands of both of the black hands of Mephala.
Both of the jazz hands,
you know?
Of Mephala.
Yeah. So there you go. But it is such a good, this is why Mephala is like one of my favorite. I think there's so much complexity there, and there's so many tie-ins, and I think it's obviously supported by connections to like Boethia and Lorcan and so on. This is why I think the good Daedra are like the pinnacle of Daedric lore. I think like the most interesting, but, yeah, it's definitely interesting, the idea that words, words and swords are either cut with a blade or cut with words.
And it's kind of like that direct lesson of hers, if you think of it, like you are, I mean, it's very literal, but you're betraying people and gaining benefit because of it. Like, yeah. Obviously she could teach that in ways that are less direct, but it, you know, it's kind of like a manifestation of that. And speaking of her fangs, there is actually an artifact called Mephala's Teacher, which kind of from Elder Scrolls Blades, but it kind of looks like two spider fangs, a bigger one and a smaller one, hanging off a club shaped
like
weapon.
Lego to me.
Yeah, it kind of looks like dog shit.
Yeah, it's too thick. I think you could take the same concept and make it cool. I don't think the concept of that club is the problem. I think it's just how chunky and stuff it looks.
Maybe it's just the way, but even the sort of legend state that she used the club to punish her obstinate followers, to remind them that discipline is required for executing great schemes. Yeah. It seems a little like, dude, that's not her way, man.
It has two attachments.
She doesn't have to enforce discipline. She's like a liar.
She's not like Mrs.
Trump.
You know?
Yeah.
Gosh, that takes me back. It has two enchantments which freeze and tire out the victim respectively. Look, I think you could take that weapon design, make it really sleek, and get rid of the spiky trunchbull looking thing on the top, and you could give it a different theme. But I just had to acknowledge it because it's been added by Elder Scrolls Blades, and I think most people don't actually know about it. So that's that. Obviously we talked about the Ring of Khajiit or Khajiiti, which was stolen from her.
And that's where it gets its name, really, because it was stolen by a thief god, like a Khajiit thief, Rajin, who became a thief god. So he actually gave the ring the infamy, really. It's like its very name. It's because of him.
And that has some interesting effects. It depends, though, on... we don't really see it anymore, but it was actually in like all of the Elder Scrolls games before Skyrim, even, I think. Like, it has quite a bit of history. And in Morrowind, it fortified speed and made you invisible. It was interesting how, invisibility for 30 seconds, but it's a ring, like, enchantments in Morrowind versus... You know how Skyrim's is
very,
like...
Yeah, because it just became that little spell slot that you could turn on, and that uses some of the enchantment. It functioned almost like kind of like a weapon, in a way, in a weapon enchant. You know, you use it and so on. You can just turn it on as one of the...
Oblivion had fortify speed and chameleon 35%, which could be useful in like a chameleon stack, but I kind of didn't like it because on its own, 35% chameleon's nothing to brag about. But I can see its advantage, like if you use other chameleon things on top of it and you get really high and no one can see you. You just have invisibility in Daggerfall with it, I believe. When you use it, you get invisibility. You also get something called Feat of Notorgo, which I'm not sure what it does. It just, it's not specified, at least where I'm checking.
Another one we should mention is the Threads of the Web Spinner, but I don't really think those... like they are like Threads of the Web Spinner. They're supposed to be gifts for the Morag Tong, but Sanguine created them for her. So it's kind of like, I don't know, they're just random pieces of jewelry and stuff you can collect in the Morrowind game. There's nothing, I think, all that special about them.
So Feat of Notorgo is a restoration spell. It's basically a boost speed spell. So same principle behind it. Makes you fast and invisible.
Very cool. Very yep. in Mephala's flavor.
Yeah. And the Obsidian Husk is technically an artifact. It's like an Elder Scrolls Online thing. It's a magical stone. It's just very mysterious and has certain magics tied to it.
Yeah, it's nothing crazy. And it goes on with the spider cult, which is basically a devotee cult of Mephala, and they have like a widow as their leader. And
They can kind of use it to grant themselves similar abilities not similar, I'd say, but that idea of agility. Like, so the spider cultists used it to enchant others. The afflicted are shrouded in shadow. They get supernatural agility and strength, interestingly, but lose their mind and, you know, they become these shades who go crazy and whatever.
I wonder if it's worth noting, because it just reminded me that the part of the triad, Clavicus Vile Nocturnal and Mephala, that originally sought to take the Heart of Transparent Law from the Crystal Tower to try and create their sort of own realm, until Nocturnal betrayed them both and wanted it all for herself, and then Mephala and Clavicus Vile then sort of team up with you to help you thwart Nocturnal. It's just kind of interesting in, I guess, that sort of motivation, and I wonder if it has anything like to, I don't know.
Yeah, like it is cool to see Daedra Lords interacting and collaborating, but sometimes it's hard to understand quite why.
Also, I guess there you can also just see how there's another example of a blind spot, but, you know, Mephala was betrayed by Nocturnal along with Clavicus Vile. So there's another blind spot. I guess one other thing to mention is also Spider Daedra, one of her servants. Naturally, you can imagine that spiders, spidery-looking things.
Quite a creepy Daedra. They almost have that siren or mermaid element to them, you know, like a half a woman with her breasts out, essentially, but the bottom half is, I guess, much more scary than a mermaid, in my opinion. It's a giant spider, but you know, the idea of how a mermaid would like beckon and call to a sailor or something like that, or a siren, and you could imagine that aligns with her sphere perfectly.
Yeah. I did one other tiny detail, because their hair reminds me of this, but apparently I'm finding the source, because I don't want the source to be trust me, bro. But so it's from Skalg's journal, but it was saying about this person that her hair is silver, long and thin, which is a clear sign for being the spider's champion. So it's just interesting that some of her champions, perhaps, imagine if you like followed her, like, or something, you get some.
Do you know of the Spider Kith?
Have you heard of the Spider Kith?
Have you heard of the Spider Kith? It's an Elder Scrolls Online thing. They're like intelligent, kind of like, you know how Dremora are like humanoid,
yeah,
intelligent Daedra that serve various Daedric princes, like a Mephala version of that with webbed skin, and they also have that white kind of hair or beards. I mean, you can just type in Spider Kith and look at the pictures of them. Like a Zivali, they do have a very different patterning, but a red They have red marks over them as well as a blue or grayish looking skin.
Yeah.
And they, you know, can kind of climb up on the web and they look very acrobatic and magical.
Mm.
They can also raise spiders, which is interesting.
But yeah, I think also, I mean, last mention about the spider or so on that's kind of thematic is even, you know, the Black Widow spider like mates and has sex with and then kills them. It's like sex and murder, both things being embodied in that kind of one spider. But I feel like that's it. If you wanted it, like if anyone of you guys are curious, The Complexities of Mephala is a video I wrote that probably more neatly articulates a bunch of the things we've talked about here, but then you don't get the enthusiastic blabbering
back and forth,
which everyone enjoys.
The rambling. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of the Mephala podcast. So thank you everyone for watching. We really appreciate all your support and that you love all this stuff as much as we do. Let us know in the comments too, like what podcast topics you'd be keen to hear us talk about for about an hour. And yeah, social media links are in the description. Patreon link, merchandise link if you want to support the channel and get a sick t-shirt. And we all look forward to nerding out with you again very soon.